Habakkuk chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. So this week was a fun and eventful week for me because my mom, my dad, and my nephew were in town. And so my nephew was born about a month after my oldest son, Drew, was born. And so he's 9, and Drew is 9, and my son, Zach, is 7. So as you can imagine, it was just a really, really big party this week at my house. So Will stayed in my house, and I played video games and ate and played video games and danced and played video games. All we just really, really enjoyed themselves. But I had a kind of a moment where I had to catch myself because I had forgotten for a minute that Will was 9 years old. That's my nephew. So I have a 9-year-old boy in my house and a 7-year-old boy in my house. And I got confused into thinking that they do things uniquely to them that all 9-year-old boys do. But my nephew kind of caught me up on that and said, no, this is something that all 9-year-old boys do. And the thing that all 9-year-old boys do is ask a bunch of questions. Every time we got ready to go somewhere, I was hit with, Uncle Deezy, where we going? Why are we doing that? Yes, they call me Uncle Deezy. A regrettable moment when I was younger, but the kids have kind of latched on to it, and so, you know, it's going to be kind of interesting when I'm 60 and they call me Uncle Deezy, and people are going to be looking at me like, what planet are you from? And he has this really thick southern drawl, and so I think I had kind of gotten mesmerized by how he sounds and this kind of cute, bubbly personality into thinking that, nah, he's not like my sons. But sure enough, every time we got ready to go somewhere, he said the exact same thing that they saw. Uncle Deezy, where are we going? Why are we going there? Why we got to do that? And I realized that I had learned how to filter out my own kids. Because they absolutely do the same thing. Every time we get in the car, get ready to go somewhere, the first question is, where are we going and what are we trying to do? But I've just kind of learned to say, I'm just going to let that go through and just say, get in the car and let's go. And that's all we're doing with it. But it kind of messed me up to hear it coming from Will. And I was like, oh, what? You do that too? And then I found myself getting frustrated. And I'll talk about that frustration a little bit later. But I realized that I had to let him make it because I was once a 9-year-old boy. And I was full of questions, always wanting to ask where we're going and what we're doing. The only difference was that I was born and I grew up in the 1980s. And I have a strong affinity for having my head affixed to my neck. Okay. So even though when my parents have said, boy, get up, it's time to go, the questions came up in my mind, but I had good enough sense not to actually let it come out my mouth about what I wanted to do because I wanted to keep my body intact. And so I just realized, I was like, okay, they're growing up in a different day and age where kids are granted a little more agency and freedom of speech that I just didn't have growing up. But I was like, okay, I get where he's coming from, and I understand that he is a person who asks questions. And then as I started examining it more fully, I realized that as people, we never really grow out of that mentality and mode of wanting to ask questions and wanting to assess what's going on around us in situations. I'm going to use a couple generalities, so if this doesn't apply to you, don't send me an email. Send it to Pastor Brandon. If you ever are in a crowded place where people are kind of moving to and fro and you're walking with a woman, when you see another woman approaching from the distance, take a second to look at the woman that you're with and notice what she does when that woman walks past. And it looks a little bit something like this. You'll catch them walking, and then you'll just see this move right here real quick, and they'll just keep on going. And if you're not paying attention, you'll miss that move. And even the more subtle ones won't even move the head. They'll just move the eyes up and down. And what they're doing is this quick retinal scan of what's going on with the woman that's walking past them. And in that scan, they're just kind of tabulating this database of questions and assessments of what they're seeing in front of us. And so they're looking, they're like, okay, that blouse is cute. Or, baby, them shoes do not go with that dress. they're looking at the hair, and I mean, it's just this quick moment where they're just looking at the situation and assessing it. You know, they're probably not going to be so impolite as to say something, but they're always, well, not all of them, let's say some, are processing and viewing and assessing what they see in front of them. But before we clown women too much, men are guilty of the exact same thing. We just do it in arenas such as sports. Prime example, the Super Bowl this past year. Many of you were watching, and if any of you were on social media right at the end of the game, you may have thought that Facebook or Twitter was broken based on a decision that was made at the end of the game. So we're watching the game. Seattle has the ball on the 1 yard line. They have a running back who is a big, strapping buck of a man. His nickname is Beast Mode. They are 1 yard line from winning the game. And inexplicably, they decide not to give the ball to the man named Beast Mode, but to throw the ball to some guy who I still don't know his name. And of course, it was intercepted, and Seattle goes and loses the game. And to this day, I'm still scratching my head as to why did they not give the ball to Marshawn Lynch? And if you turn on sports talk radio, which is all about assessments all day, all the time, it's all these questions about why did they make that decision and why did they do that? So men in general are assessors. They're always processing things, especially in sports, and analyzing things and asking questions of what they see and why things are as they are. But we don't just, we're not just assessors in the realm of fashion or sports. We just tend to look at life and assess everything that we see and view it and have commentary and ideas on how things should go based on what we see. And that's not a bad thing. In fact, it's God-given, that ability and proclivity to assess. How do I know? God gave us eyes to see and view what's going on around us. But God didn't just give us eyes to see and view what's going on around us. He also gave us a brain to be able to process what we're seeing and make assessments of things that we're seeing as we move to and fro in our lives. And so assessing things in general is not a bad thing. In fact, it's something that we were created to do. Assessing things also do not just stop in the realm of things that we are viewing in terms of menial things like fashion or sports, but we assess everything that happens in life, even things that include matters that have to do with larger things such as God or life's difficult situations. When we find ourselves in challenging and uncomfortable circumstances, we don't turn off our ability to assess things. In fact, we look at these things and say, all right, I'm in this situation. I don't really like the situation that I'm in. There's some things that I know about God, but I'm not seeing those things being made evident in the situation that I'm in. And so we start asking questions to God about, God, what are you doing here? What is this situation all about? God, this is not making sense to me. I'm looking at this situation. I know who you are. But as I'm in the situation, I don't see you acting or moving in the situation, and this is not making sense. Here's some examples for you. We all know that God says that he is our provider. And those of us who've placed our faith and trust in God and says, okay, God, I believe that, and I'm acting out on that, and I've accepted employment opportunities in light of you saying that you are my provider. But God, why at the end of the month, after I paid all my bills, and I reach in my pocket, all I get is lint?
Yeah, what's up with that?
What's up with that? What's up with that? We're assessing the situation and saying, God, I'm looking at this situation. I'm thinking you should be in this, but I don't see you. I don't see what's going on. What's up with that, God? We do that in family situations. We say, well, God, I understand that you desire for me to have my work and life in balance. And so I'm going to cut back hours at the job and spend more time around my family. But then you get home and you start dealing with your wife and you start dealing with your kids and they start asking all these questions. And you realize you're like, well, this didn't turn out like I thought it should. God, I thought that you wanted me to be more present in my home, to be a leader in my home, to guide my spouse or to interact well with my spouse, to love and raise my kids. But this situation is not going as I would have expected it to go. I'm doing what I think you want me to do, or I'm acting in a manner that seemingly reflects you, but I'm not getting the response that I think that I should get. So God, what's up with that? We're assessing situations like this and wondering what's going on and how things should be, because it doesn't seem like God is either on his job or doing what we think he should be doing. Another situation that's really near and dear to my heart, and as I've gotten older, I've learned not to take certain things like the ability to have children for granted. So I often hear in talking with friends and loved ones in kind of in this season of life who are struggling with issues of infertility or wanting to adopt or foster, and they'll say, I've heard many people say things like this: God, you know that I desire to have a child and to raise that child in a way that honors you, but either I can't physically do it, or because of the process of adoption, the cost of it, and all the hoops that I have to jump through, I'm struggling with wanting to do something for you, something that I think that you would honor, but I can't make it come to pass. And what's really messed up is I'm looking at these other folks out here who just are having babies left and right, not paying attention, not caring, and not with an ability to take care of them, not being able to provide a stable home. But here I am, God, have a stable home, wanting to do for these kids, and yet I can't have them, or the process of adoption is just so rigorous that it can't come to pass. And so you're looking at that situation and saying, God, something seems off here. Something seems messed up. What's up with that? You're going to help me today, Shereen. What's up with that? And so today I want us to look at a passage where there's a man, a prophet named Habakkuk, who was in a situation where he was assessing his circumstance, where he was living, and he did not see God acting in a manner that was consistent with who he knew God to be. And we see him engaged in this dialogue, this ongoing dialogue with God, and he's saying to God, effectively, what's up with that? So before we hop into the passage, let's get situated with where we are in the history of Israel. So we know from Genesis 12, God told Abraham that you're going to be my guy, and through you, I'm going to make a nation out of many, many descendants, and I'm going to give that nation a special place to live, and I'm going to give them a special responsibility to represent me to all of the nations that are surrounding. And you will show them, based on how you interact with me and based on our intimate relationship, you will show them what it's like to live and love faithfully with the God of the universe. And so God delivered them from slavery in Egypt. And as they were proceeding toward the promised land, God made a promise to them. And he said that if you, Israel, would be faithful to me and you will keep my covenant, I will bless and I will take care of you. But if you are not faithful to me and you rebel against me, there will be punishment and judgment that will come upon you. But it won't be just because I'm a masochist and want to see you punished. It will be for the purpose of drawing you back to me. And so Israel proceeds forward and they enter the promised land. And after being in the promised land, they ask God for an earthly king. And God gives them several kings. And we know King Saul, King David, King Solomon. And after King Solomon, it came time for the next king. And there was division that broke out within the midst of the Israelite people. And the division was so great that it broke up into two kingdoms, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. So the northern kingdom was characterized by rampant rebellion. They really didn't do a good job of following the covenant and what God wanted them to do. And God did as he said he would do. He punished them and allowed judgment to come upon them, and they were overtaken by the Assyrians. But there was this group, the southern kingdom, that was characterized by a little more faithfulness to God and to his covenant. And so the people of the southern kingdom, also known as the Judean kingdom, they had kings who led them in a way that represented God and showed for them to show the nation surrounding them what being in relationship with God should be like. However, Judah was also affected with the same disease that the northern kingdom was, in that they were drawn to idolatry and drawn to turning away from God and looking to other nations and other gods for their helps and strength. And so God was beginning to bring punishment down on them. And so we find Habakkuk living in Judah in this time where he's looking out and saying, the people of Judah are rebelling against God. They're worshiping idols. They are not following the ways of God. They're disrespecting the law. And Habakkuk is looking at this situation and assessing it and saying, there's something that's not right about what's going on here. And we see, we're going to pick up here in verse 1, and we're going to see this dialogue that goes on back and forth between Habakkuk and God about what he's assessing in this situation. Chapter 1, verse 1, the oracle that Habakkuk the prophet saw. This is Habakkuk talking to God. O Lord, how long shall I cry for help, and you will not hear, or cry to you violence, and you will not save? Why do you make me see iniquity, and why do you idly look at wrong? Destruction and violence are before me, and strife and contention arise. So the law is paralyzed, and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous, so justice goes forth perverted. So here's Habakkuk. He's looking and assessing his situation of what's going on in Judah, and he's seeing things and saying, you know what, God, something's not right about this. Our people are rebelling against you. They're not following the law. Justice is being perverted. People are being violent. There's destruction all around. And this is not the way that you called us to be. And God, I know what your promises are. I know what you said, that if our people would be faithful, that you would bless us. But if we rebelled against you, that you would bring judgment. And Habakkuk is looking around and say, God, where are you? What are you doing? How long are you going to let this go on? God, I know some things about you. I know that you care about this. I know these are your people. So where are you? Why are you not acting? How long do I have to keep crying out for you to do something about this situation? Knock, knock. Hello, God, are you awake? Why are you not doing something? And he also asks, not just why are you not doing something, but why are you idly sitting back and looking at wrong? That's confusing. That's not who you are. That's not who I know you to be. So why aren't you doing something about this, God? This is inconsistent with what your character is and what I know your nature to be. And so he's looking at the situation, and his assessment is, God, I don't know what you're doing. Have you ever been in that situation?
My goodness.
Where you're looking around and trying to figure out what's going on, and it just absolutely doesn't make any sense to you. Have you ever cried out to God, God, what are you doing here? God, have you forgotten who you are? Have you forgotten about the situation that I'm in? God, are you awake? Is anybody up there?
Yeah.
How long do I have to cry out to you to do something and to change my circumstance? God answers him in verses 5 through 11. God says, look among the nations and see wonder and be astounded, for I'm doing a work in your days that you would not believe if told. For behold, I'm raising up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation who march through the breadth of the earth to seize dwellings not their own. They are dreaded and fearsome. Their justice and dignity go forth from themselves. Their horses are swifter than leopards, more fierce than the evening wolves. Their horsemen press proudly on. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like an eagle swift to devour. They all come for violence. All of their faces forward, they gather captives like sand. At kings they scoff, at rulers they laugh. They laugh at every fortress, for they pile up earth and take it. Then they sweep like the wind and go on, guilty men, whose might is their God. So God answers Habakkuk. And he says, hey man, I'm about to tell you something that's going to blow your socks off.
Yeah.
He said, I'm not asleep. I'm not unaware of the situation. I haven't changed. Everything is as it should be from my perspective. And I'm going to handle this situation. But here's how I'm going to handle it. I'm going to raise up the Babylonians, also known as the Chaldeans. And I'm going to use the Babylonians to be my instrument and tool of judgment on my people. When Habakkuk heard this, or anybody hearing this, they would have been absolutely shocked by it. Because the Babylonians were a very wicked and evil people. And they ran roughshod over other nations, not caring much about their humanity or what they had going on. In today's terms, if you think of ISIS in Syria or Iraq, or think of Boko Haram in Nigeria, and some of the methods that they use in creating terror, the Babylonians were that bad, but they just weren't this little small group They had like the might and the power as if it was the United States military equipped with such ruthless tactics. And so they just ran roughshod over whoever came up against them. They loved violence, and their God was their might. They really reveled in the fact that they were able to just crush and run over other nations. And so like this verse here in verse 10, it talks about how they laughed at fortresses. So cities back then, in order to protect themselves, they would build these tall walls to keep other nations, invading nations, out. But the Babylonians, what they would do, they would carry dirt. And they would carry dirt with them, and they would start piling it on the wall. And they would start packing it up on the wall and building a mound and a hill so large that eventually they just could scale the wall and get right over it. But they had so many people, and they were so determined to do it, they did this very swiftly. So this was not a situation that was taking years to do. I mean, they just had folks just coming in piling dirt. And before you know it, the army was over the mount, over the fortress, and they were into the city and just taking over. And they were violent when they came in and took over. And so the people of Israel, and especially Habakkuk, is listening to this. And this had to sound very, very scary and very, very odd. Because he's like, okay, God, you are up to something, but it's the Babylonians you're going to use? This is going to be your instrument of judgment? This is what you're going to do? And so when Habakkuk asked God the question of, how long, God, and are you going to do something? God answers with a resounding yes. But he gives him an answer that I'm sure was perplexing to him. And we'll see it here in verse 12 through the rest of the chapter. So Habakkuk responds back to God. He says, God, are you not from everlasting? O Lord, my God, my Holy One, we shall not die. O Lord, you have ordained the misjudgment, and you, O Rock, have established them for reproof. You who are of purer eyes than to see evil and cannot look at wrong, why do you idly look at traitors and remain silent when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he? You make mankind like fish of the sea, like crawling things that have no ruler. He brings them up with a hook. He drags them out with a net. He gathers them in his dragnet. So he rejoices and is glad. Therefore, he sacrifices to his net and makes offerings to his dragnet. For by them he lives in luxury and his food is rich. Is he then to keep on emptying his net and mercilessly killing nations forever? I will take my stand at the watchpost and station myself on the tower and look to see what he will say to me, and I will answer concerning my complaint. So Habakkuk hears what God is going to do, and as we would expect, he's very perplexed by what God is going to do. And he starts off first by saying, well, God, there's some things that I understand about you, and you kind of clarify some things. He said, yes, God, you're still in control. This, oh, Lord, you're still sovereign. He calls him the Holy One. You're still different. You're still pure. So you haven't changed in your character and nature. So I get that. And so he can stay confidently that we shall not die. So he knows that even though you're going to use the Babylonians to punish us, you're not going to wipe us out because we're still your people. So you're going to use them to punish us and to discipline us, but hopefully our response will be that we will return to you through it. You're just not going to eradicate us. So I'm cool with that, God. But I still have a problem. In verse 13, he says, why do you look idly at traitors and remain silently when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he? Yeah. So Habakkuk is sitting back and looking at the situation and assessing it and saying, okay, God, do you really know what you're doing? Do you really know what you're doing? Okay, I had that first question that, do you see what's going on? And yeah, you see what's going on and you're going to do something about it. But I'm still left to question, do you know what's going on? Because you're talking about using some wicked people to punish us. Is that really the way you want to do it? And Habakkuk was not just looking at it from the standpoint of the people who were rebelling within Judah. He was also looking at the point of the righteous remnant that was within Judah. So he's saying, okay, God, everybody in here is not wilding out. But everybody, even the people who are faithful to you, are going to have to experience the wrath of the Babylonians. Oh, wow. God, do you know what you're doing? Do you really want to do that? And then he goes through here in verses 14 to 17 to kind of remind God of who the Babylonians are. He's like, you know, these people, they treat men like fish, and they just gather them up in a net and get more and gather them up in the net, and they don't care about their humanity. They just keep sweeping them up, And they're so powerful that that they're able to become wealthy off of how they're able to run over nations. And they celebrate what they're doing, and they attribute their power to the nets that they have. And so they attribute the power, their power and might to their military strength. And that's the thing that they trust in. And so Habakkuk is looking at this situation and say, God, this just doesn't make any sense. I don't know what you're doing. But not only do I not know what you're doing, God, I kind of don't agree with what you're doing. Have you ever told God that?
Yes, indeed. Yes.
God, I'm assessing the situation that I'm in.
Yeah.
I'm assessing the circumstances that I'm in. I'm looking around, and this is just kind of really messed up. Mm-hmm. And God, it actually seems like you're hustling backwards. Ooh. Evil people are going to prosper, and I'm your boy.
Yeah.
Or I'm your girl. Mm-hmm. I'm your daughter. Your son, you love me, and yet you're going to expose me to this level of destruction or punishment or hardship. Have you asked the question, God, do you know what you're doing? Or have you been so bold enough to tell God that I don't agree with what you're doing? So Habakkuk lays all of this out, and he says, okay, God, I've kind of registered my complaint. I'm going to go up here and stand in this watchtower and see what you have to say to that complaint that I have. God answers him beginning in verse 2. It says, and the Lord answered me, write the vision, make it plain on tablets so he may run who reads it. For still the vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. If it seems slow, wait for it.
Come on.
If it seems slow, wait for it.
Yeah.
It will surely come. It will surely come.
Mm-hmm.
It will not delay.
Mm-hmm.
Behold, his soul is puffed up. It is not upright within him, but the righteous shall live by his faith.
Yeah.
So God responds to Habakkuk's question and assessment of, God, do you know what you're doing? And God, I don't agree with what you're doing. And God tells him, I need you to write this down. I need you to write this down in a way that's very permanent and very clear for you to see. So clear for you to see that you can go run and tell other people what I'm about to tell you. So clear that somebody running past these tablets that you're going to write it down with, they can see, even though they're running as fast as Usain Bolt.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Make it clear. Write it down. Make it clear. Because what I'm telling you is going to happen is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But you're going to have to wait.
Oh, my goodness.
But you're going to have to wait. God let him know that I'm going to take care of this. I have not abdicated my throne. I have not forgotten about this situation. I'm not surprised at what's happening here. I do have a plan for what's going to happen here. But what I need you to do is I need you to wait. I need you to wait. And then he gets crystal clear and more explicit for why he needs him to wait. And he says, in verse 4, he said, behold, his soul is puffed up. It is not upright within him. This is God speaking about the Babylonians. The Babylonians trusted in themselves. They were proud people that trusted in their own might. That was their God. And God says, it is not upright with them, but the righteous shall live by faith. God told Habakkuk, I'm going to take care of the Babylonians. I'm going to take care of the rebellious Judeans. I'm going to take care of the righteous Judeans. I am on my job. Now it's time for you to get on your job.
Yeah, my goodness.
And your job is that you live by faith.
Oh, wow.
Your job is that you live by faith. Don't trust in your own self. Trust in me.
Come on.
And you live by faith. This is the money verse in the whole passage. Some people say it's the money verse in the whole Old Testament. It's quoted several times in the New Testament. And that's the main point of this message, is that you live by faith. So here's Habakkuk in an uncomfortable situation. He doesn't understand what God is doing. And then when he gains a little bit of clarity about what God is doing, he doesn't agree with what God is doing. And God tells him that, I got this. I'm still in control. I'm still in command. I'm going to take care of everything. But what I need you to do is I need you to live by faith. I need for you to trust me. I need for you to trust me. I need for you to trust me when the things are not happening in the timing that you expect it to happen in.
Come on, come on.
I need you to trust me after you've gotten tired of waiting. I need for you to trust me that even when the situation actually gets worse than what it presently is, to know that I have the situation under control.
Yes.
We don't have time, and so we're just summarizing verses 6 through 20 in chapter 2. God's letting them know that, no, I'm going to take care of the Babylonians as well. You know, they're a violent people. They are their own gods. They shame people. They're immoral. And they're idolaters. They make their own gods. And God is telling them, the Babylonians, that I'm going to take care of you too. Destruction is going to come your way. Justice is going to be served as a dish very cold to you.
Yeah.
It's coming to you. So God is like, Habakkuk, I'm going to take care of them. I didn't lose my character. I didn't lose my way. Wicked people will get punished. But what I need for you to do is I need for you to live by faith. So what do we do with that? What do we do with that? The answer is simple, is that we are to live by faith. We are not to just intellectualize our lives by faith. We are to live by faith. We're not simply just to say, okay, God, I get what you're saying. I understand what you're supposed to do, but in the midst of this thing, I'm still wondering, what are you doing and why you're doing it? No, we're supposed to live by faith. In the midst of a situation where once we've questioned what's going on and we've questioned it and received an answer, even if that answer comes back in a manner that's unsatisfactory to us, God is telling us that we are to live by faith.
My goodness.
Questioning God is not a bad thing. I need for you, everyone, to understand that. Questioning God is not a bad thing. This first two chapters, this is a man, God's man, questioning God about, God, what are you doing? This is an open, honest dialogue about what's going on. It's okay to question God, but what happens after you receive the answer? I think about Jesus when he was in the Garden of Gethsemane facing the cross. He asked God a question. He said, God, is there any other way that we can do this? Is there a way for this bitter cup to pass? Do I have to go through this particular suffering? But after he asked that question, the next thing he says, God, it's not my will, but your will be done. Jesus was demonstrating that he trusted in what God had for him.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he questioned, was there another way that he could do it?
Yeah.
It's okay to question, but what do you do after you receive the answer?
Sir.
The righteous will live by faith.
Mm-hmm.
It's not easy. It absolutely isn't easy. But the righteous will live by faith. So I told you that with my nephews and my sons hopping in the car every time, questioning where are we going and why are we going. And I mentioned that it was frustrating. And as I examined my heart about why was it frustrating, I landed here. And what I landed on was, it was frustrating. Questions demonstrated trust my decision making.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I'm looking at them, yeah. And I'm like, okay, I was 9 years old once. I know what a nine-year-old how a nine-year-old mind works. I am 30-plus 9 years old now. And I know 3 million times more than your nine-year-old self knows. So why are you questioning me when I know what we have next on the schedule? I have an ability to drive that you don't yet have. I have money in my pocket to fund whatever endeavor we're about to get into next. So how can you have the gall and audacity to question the thing that I'm going to do? And I realized, I was like, it's frustrating because you're demonstrating that you don't trust my decision making. The righteous shall live by faith. After you have received your answer, even if that answer is unsatisfactory, we are in a place where we know very little. We don't know the future. We have some broad brushstrokes of God's greater plan, but we don't know exactly how he's going to met it out and how that thing will get lived out. So we're in a place just like my sons and nephew was. We're in a limited scope and perspective on things. But if we absolutely trust who God is, then we can live through it. But it depends on what do you think of God? Is God who he says he is? Is he good? Is he your provider? Is he going to take care of you? Do you trust that he keeps his word? If you do, then you can live in light of that trust. The righteous will live by faith. You are going to continue to experience things in your life that are going to make you uncomfortable, that are going to be challenging for you, challenging to you. And many times it will look like God is either not present or sleeping on the job. But you have to remind yourself about who God is and what he's done and take confidence in that and hold tightly to that as you wait. Because God said it's going to happen. It surely is going to come to pass. Just wait on it. But your response is that you live by faith. My challenge to each of you is that if you are righteous, if you are one who has been redeemed by the blood of Jesus, then my challenge to you is to live by faith. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for you being unchangeable. We thank you that you are a covenant-keeping God, that even when we are unfaithful, that you are faithful. We thank you that you will exhaust no means in drawing us back to you. Help us, Lord. Help us, Lord, to cling to you in those uncomfortable times. Point us back to you. Point us back to your justice and your mercy and your righteousness and your character that we can sink our fingers into and cling to that even as we assess situations that seem like that you're not in control. Help us, God, to represent you, even in the midst of situations of struggle and hardship. Help us, God, to live by faith. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.